Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 6, delivered on January 29, 2015. The title of this lecture is Review of Accounting.
Today, Review of Accounting. This is a one-lecture review, and I will tell you everything that you need to know about how to be an accountant, or at least what we care about from accounting in finance. A little while into the lecture, I'm going to hand out a worksheet for you, and we'll start the worksheet here in class. You will then finish the worksheet at home or wherever you call home, and when you have gotten the numbers in, you'll fill them in on a Reginet quiz. Put this number here, put this number here. And by the end, and that will be a quiz that will pop up. I'll put it up starting tomorrow morning, and I do have to open the other ones for some people anyway. So, get off me. So, we'll start this process here, and I'm sure you all remember all of your accounting from your accounting classes, so that's not going to be much of an issue, although it might be more of an issue considering that the marker that I left here has now been swiped, but I'll cross that bridge here in a minute. I do want to show you, before I begin the review of accounting, I want to show you one last thing about Federal Reserve policy and open market operations. There are two instruments that are used in open market operations, cash and treasury bills, right? Now, the desk traders have cash and treasury bills. The banks have cash and treasury bills. And they swap them back and forth to cause liquidity to be added to the federal funds market or for liquidity to be drained. So, for example, if the Fed wants to add liquidity, the traders simply try to buy treasury bills from the banks. As the demand for the treasury bills goes up, the prices go up, yields go down, and then as the banks then say, yes, I will sell one of these treasury bills to you traders, the bank gives up a treasury bill, gets money, and that money goes into the federal funds pool. The supply of lendable funds in the federal funds market goes up, and the federal funds rate goes down. All that kind of stuff. But for what I'm saying, going to show you right here, just remember that the Federal Reserve, in order to execute open market operations, which are its most common tool for conducting monetary policy, the Federal Reserve needs to have currency and treasury bills. The currency it prints as the agent of the treasury. The treasury bills it gets by buying them at the government's treasury auctions. The Treasury Department simply to borrow money when the government doesn't have enough money from tax revenues, the government simply has auctions. They sell treasury bills, treasury notes, and treasury bonds. That's the borrowing of the government. They borrow money when they don't have enough of their own money to cover their bills. And so we run deficits as an economy. The government runs federal budget deficits. What that means is that the Fed runs these auctions, selling its treasury instruments as the way it borrows money. The Fed participates in those auctions by going there and buying a bunch of that stuff, that paper, that treasury paper. which the Fed then uses in the open market operations to move the money supply up and down. As long as you can get that idea, let me show you a kind of an interesting picture here. Now, this was a graph that I made as of 2008 about our federal budget deficits. We had been running them blood red federal budget deficits since the time of Eisenhower. They were getting worse and worse through the years. We had the guns and butter program of Lyndon Johnson fighting a war on poverty on the home front, fighting the war in Southeast Asia on the foreign front. And then we had the Nixon years, and then we had Ford, and then Carter, and then Reagan's tax cuts. That made the budget deficits swell again because obviously not enough tax revenue, so budget deficits went up. And George H.W. Bush, his vice president, Reagan's vice president, came into office, budget deficits getting worse and worse. So that's where we begin the story, during the years of George H.W. Bush. More and more money being borrowed to cover the government's bills. But then the longest, most sustained economic expansion in U.S. history began. This was the bottom, the last year of George H.W. Bush's presidency. And this was the Clinton years. The budget deficits started to contract, because the economy was doing so well. Tax revenues were stable. There weren't tax increases, tax cuts. They just stayed where they were. And essentially, the budget deficits began to shrink. And they shrank. And they shrank. By the time we get to 1998, we were no longer running budget deficits. We were running budget surpluses. So in other words, the government was no longer running auctions at the Treasury, no longer selling Treasury instruments. No more Treasury bills, no more Treasury notes, no more Treasury bonds. Now, there was some agency debt still being issued by agencies of the government like the TVA and a couple of others, but the main Treasury auctions were over. There was no auction in 99, 2000, 2001. In other words, the Federal Reserve's primary tool for managing the economy, the open market operations, could no longer be executed because there were no more Treasury bills as part of the portfolio of the traders at the desk, and there were no more Treasury bills in the portfolio of Tier 1 capital in the banks. It was no longer there. We were running budget surpluses, which, of course, meant a couple of things, really cool things. We could start paying off the national debt, the accumulation of all the budget deficits from years before. We could start talking about expanding programs, like bringing back the education grants that had been so generous in the 80s. We could start talking about more space exploration. We could talk about more endowments for basic research and helping companies do their industrial innovations for the technological era. All of that was happening. We were going to start taking care of the problems of the last 50 years. But then something funny happened. No recession happened, and yet at this point, when the new president came into power, there was this sudden thing that, oh, we've got this terrible recession. We have got to enact the largest, longest, deepest tax cuts in U.S. history. Right away, because the economy is in such a bad recession, even though there was no recession. And Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, came to agree with them. Yeah, there's a really bad economy. These tax cuts are absolutely necessary. We have got to stop this horrible recession. And so those largest, deepest tax cuts in U.S. history came about, which means that the tax revenues of the U.S. government collapsed. And then we had a theater war begin in Afghanistan, and then a theater war begin down south in Iraq, and look what happened. Back down into budget deficits year over year, which simply meant for the Federal Reserve that all of a sudden the Treasury auctions began again, and they could go to them and buy Treasury bills, and they could use those Treasury bills to start running the economy again through open market operations. Do you understand the incentive of Alan Greenspan, who knew damn well better than to claim that there was a recession? He said, oh yeah, we're in a bad recession. He, as well as others, wanted the budget deficits to return in spades, because then the open market operations could begin again and the Federal Reserve would then again be in control of the economy as it had been before. In fact, even in the last years of these budget deficits shrinking, Greenspan kept saying, this isn't real. This is irrational exuberance of the stock markets. This is going to end. And it never did. Even though he went to Congress in 1995, he said, oh, this is just irrational exuberance. And in order to try to stop this massive expansion, the Federal Reserve in this period had upped the discount rate 8 consecutive times, the most consecutive increases in the discount rate in the history of the Fed, trying to stop this massive expansion that was going on. All it did was snap the dot-coms. They were so interest rate fragile that it killed them. But the economy just kept growing and growing and growing. Even though the Fed's discount rate was pushing up and up, essentially because the Fed was losing its power. So even though it was trying to stop the economic growth, it couldn't. And so when they had a more favorable political environment in Washington, that's when they just knocked those tax rates down so that there was no longer that economic expansion. Go.
Yeah, can you define irrational exuberance?
I can't. Oh. That was Alan Greenspan's term. Irrational exuberance of a stock market. Saying the stock market is irrational is like saying that a meteorite slamming into New York City is irrational. It's a force of nature. Stock markets are animals. They are neither irrational nor rational. They just are. But he said, oh, the stock market's going up and up and up, and it's just irrationality. Anytime you think that the stock market is being irrational, go ahead and fight the stock market. Buck it. Go sell against the bulls. Buy against the bears. You'll find out that usually you get your clock clean, because it doesn't matter what you think. The market's going to do what it thinks. And in this period of time, the stock market was roaring upward. Unemployment fell below what economists thought was the natural rate. It was down around 3% finally. You had growth of employment was staggeringly high all through this period, closing the gap. And it was largely because it wasn't that we had high taxes or low taxes. We had a stable tax structure. We had a Republican Congress, a Democrat president. Both of them were kind of dodgy, but they managed to create an incredible economic environment. Sort of two counter forces that actually created quite a waltz. There was where we could have been. We could have been doing this. You could have been in an economy that never would have had that crash, or even if it had a terrible recession, we would have had plenty of budget surpluses from previous years. We could have spent that $787 billion that we did to recover from the Great Recession, and it wouldn't have caused such damage to the budget national debt as it did when we actually had to go that route. That was what could have been. And you remember that. We can't go back there. We never will go back there. We will be down here, and it will get worse over the years to come. larger and larger budget deficits, regardless of who's in office, Democrat or Republican. And it all started up here when people who just couldn't stand to step aside and yield their power over the economy, over the government's decision making, had their way. And, well, there you go. It's your problem. I'm going to be dead. You have to deal with it. Anyway, enough of that. Good times. Now, let's get on to the subject of accounting. I'm going to make this as painless as I possibly can. But unfortunately, even at that, it could be painful. You know what? It really annoys me that I had a marker that I hid here, and someone has taken that marker and swiped it. So I don't have my dry erase marker, and I don't think I hid another one in one of my pockets either. So bear with me for one moment here while I try to figure out an alternative. I'm going to have to do it. Thank you. I'm just going to have to do it that way. I had this all solved. My light, nice little whiteboardy here and all that. Whiteboardy? Well, you know what I mean. Okay. I'm going to give you some formulas that are important for this. Just basics of how we look at accounting numbers in finance. Now, the first formula that's probably going to be useful to for you to write down is the basic formula that we say revenue. Now, know this, and I'm going to show you a lot of examples of this. A word that I use here might not be the word that you see in a financial statement. And I'll try to flag you. The word revenue, what's another word that might be the same as revenue if you're looking at a financial statement? It's sales, yeah, sales. You're looking like that. Yeah, sales. It's that simple. Sales, you could see sales. Revenue, something like that, you know, and that's the, it's going to be one or the other. Revenue. Now, the next line might not be there, depending upon what kind of company it is. Take away cost of goods sold. Cost of goods sold, those are costs that are directly attributable to something you sold. Now, in other words, it would be like a manufacturing company. You made a car. Well, you bought a door for that car. So that door is directly attributable to the sale of the car. So you can take that off as a pegged cost. Give you an example in my own company. Literally, trying to shape accounting rules into the reality of writing financial statements is not all that easy in practice. In my company, I produce photographs, which I then mat and frame and sell at shows, okay, or online. Here's the problem. Okay, what about that photograph is directly attributable? I sell a framed, matted photograph for $300, okay? Okay, now, I know I spent $60 on the frame. So that would be a cost of goods sold. $300, there was $60 of that is directly, I know it was there. The mats cost about $20. Okay, I can take that off as a cost of goods sold. But then it gets more complicated. I have to buy ink all the time for this massive printer. It would be almost impossible for me to figure out exactly how many pennies or how many dollars of ink went onto that sheet. As a matter of fact, even the sheet itself, I could run 3-4 prints before I get one that is commercially saleable. So there are a lot of costs that I can't put right on. Okay, there's $300 there. 60 of it was the frame, 20 of it was the mats. But there were other costs, but I can't tell you exactly how much those other costs were. So those other costs wouldn't be in cost of goods sold. Only things that I can say right on the button, that was something that was right on that thing when I sold it. Now, if you have cost of goods sold then, when you take revenue minus cost of goods sold, what you get is gross income. Another way to say this is gross profit. But profit is kind of a dirty word, so we kind of avoid profit. So we just say gross income, or we just say gross. Okay, there's your gross. Now, once you have done the gross, now again, if it's sort of like a service industry, you wouldn't have any cost of goods sold. If it's something where none of your costs are directly attributable to the product that's sold on the shelf, then you wouldn't have this line here, that cost of goods sold. Okay, but we're going to put this in here for these purposes, for the purposes of this guy right here. Okay, now, after you've gotten to your gross line, gross income line, you're going to have several different costs. Some of them are real. Some of them are actually not real at all. A cost that would be real, or at least close to real, would be selling, general, and administrative expenses, SG&A expenses. I have to pay my salaries. I have to pay my wages. I have to pay for paper clips. I have to pay for utilities. The problem in accounting, and we'll get to this more in a minute here, but accounting is not allowed to show when the money actually is paid. In other words, accounting numbers are not about the occurrence of costs. They're about the incurrence. So, you worked for a week, I owe you a week's wages. I might not pay you for a month, but I can still say that that's my expense, your wage is my expense in the current period, because I incurred the expense even though the money didn't go out for a while. Okay? So know that about this, is that we are going to have to go into the balance sheet to fix that problem for financing, for financial analysis purposes. But that'll be a little later. Go. Selling, general, and administrative expenses. This, in my own business, would be where I would put in the cost of the ink cartridges, the cost of the massive rolls of archival expensive paper, the cost of my mailing envelopes, the cost of all those kinds of costs, cost of my internet connections and websites and all that. That's where that SG&A, it's a catch-all category which would be broken down internally, but for reporting purposes, you'll see something more summary like SG&A. But again, be wary, because they might not have actually paid the money for these, but if the bill has come and is due, then it's going to show up in an accounting financial statement. And we have to go into the balance sheet and figure out what happened there and fix it for looking at cash flow purposes. Now, here's one that's not real at all. We also have to take out depreciation. Because in accounting, if it's a capital expenditure, you are not allowed to write down the whole cost of it. In my business, I spent $2,500 on a massive printer, high commercial art quality printer. Well, I'd love to write down $2,500, but accounting rules forbid it. I have to break that cost up into seven years. So even though it cost me $2,500 out of my pocket, I am going to write off only a small amount of that every year, depreciate it down. So we're going to have to add depreciation back in because it's not a real expense. There is no such thing as depreciation in a finance and economic sense. You will never write a check to something called depreciation. I always wish that I could make a company called depreciation so that everyone had to write a check to me, to Depreciation Incorporated. But it never happened that way. But this is a mythical cost that is made so that to cover for the fact that you're not allowed in a corporation to simply write off the entirety of a massive capital expense in 1 year. So even though I blew $10 million on a building, $10 million out of the company's pocket, I can only recognize what the depreciation allowance for that year is on that building. Once you have taken those out, you get to the next income, which is called operating income. You can call it operating profit, but there's another term for it too. EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. In other words, you've cleared out all of the expenses, and now we're at the operating line where all we've got left is paying our coupons on our debts, paying our interest, and paying the Uncle Sam and the locals. So you'll hear me use these terms interchangeably. Operating income, EBIT. And again, this is one of those that is on financial statements. You'll see some financial statements that'll say operating income. Other financial statements will say earnings before interest and taxes. Others will kind of give them both, say them both. They're the same thing. It's kind of, so you just have to know, oh, these all mean the same thing. Then you subtract out your interest. How much you've paid in interest on debts that you have. And you get down to EBT, earnings before taxes. Then you take out taxes and you get net income, or net profit, or profit. Sometimes you'll even hear it called earnings. It has all kinds of different names. It's your bottom line. In other words, in an accounting sense, this is the money that belongs to the shareholders. The debt holders, all of the different kinds of debt holders, from the electric company to the wage workers, to the bondholders, to the government, they've all been taken care of for the current period. And now what we see down here is the residual claim available to the shareholders. The company can give it out as dividends, it can plow it back into operations, or it can do both. A little bit of both. That's net income. Now, let me take a side stream here and talk to you about taxes. I am always a little bit unsure how deep they take you into those first accounting courses that you all have to take with our tax system. There are different ways that taxes can be levied by a government. And actually, most governments actually do it a number of different ways. There are four basic ways that taxes can be levied in an economy by a government. There is, the first way would be to have what is called a flat tax. A flat tax is simply a fixed amount of money. You owe me $50. That's all there is. Pay me $50 and I won't send you to prison. It wouldn't matter how much you make, wouldn't matter who you are, just a flat tax. Notice that that is a very punitive tax on poor people. Well, we obviously don't have a flat tax in this country, except we do. We have many of the taxes that you pay are pure flat taxes. Your driver's license, they don't ask you how much you make. You just have to pay for it. Your license plates and stickers for your car. Your hunting license, your boat license. Your licenses in general, licensing is flat tax. In other words, it hits the poor more than it does the rich. A flat tax is actually a regressive tax on income. Now, the next one is what's called a proportional tax. Here. I think I'm going to do something here. I got this one. Let me see if this one draws a bit, well, writes a little better. A proportional tax. Now, a proportional tax is a percentage tax. A good example of a proportional tax is a sales tax. We pay in right around here, it's a 7.75% sales tax. And a sales tax is actually a very specialized example of a broader tax that's popular in other parts of the world called a value-added tax. Now, a value-added tax, just in a nutshell, the way a value-added tax works is at every stage of production, value is added to the basic thing that's going along the assembly line or from factory to factory. So the way in European countries the tax works is that there is a certain percentage tax on each value-added stage of production. So that essentially, let's say you something in the first stage, you buy raw resources for $1,000. When it goes to the second stage, the thing is worth $1,500. So then there would be a tax of $500 applied. The value added at that stage. Now, let's say it goes to the next stage, and at that next stage, the value goes from 1,500 up to, let's say, 2,500. So there's $1,000 of value added at the second stage, and so a small tax would be applied there, let's say 4% tax. So at each stage, there's a value added tax being applied. That's value added tax, popular around Europe, popular in other parts of the world. Our sales tax is actually just a value-added tax on the last stage of production, on the entire stage of production, I should say. So ours is like that. There's only one problem with a proportional tax. It is regressive, just like a flat tax is. In other words, it punishes the poor more than the rich. If we all have to pay, if we all have the same basic needs, let's try something here. Let me try something here. I'll do this as a scratch sheet down here at the bottom. Okay. Yeah. You make $10,000 a year. It didn't work out for you, you know. You make $200,000 a year. Now, have any of you, I'm sure somewhere in your past, in high school or in college, you saw that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, at the bottom layer, we all need food and sex. And once you've gotten your pizza and some ass, then you go up and you got some safety and shelter, you know, a lock on the door and a gun in case brothers show up or the wronged husband shows up. You know, you understand, you know, bro stuff. Okay. But the truth of the matter is that a rich person really doesn't need any more than a poor person does. You might think you need more, but you need no more. The same number of calories he needs, you need. The same medical attention he needs, you need. Those basics of life have the same value to both of you. Even though you may spend more on those, you don't have to. There is a core subsistence expenditure level that is to both of you. Let's say that that core subsistence that would keep body and soul alive is $2,000. It's the same whether you're rich or poor, regardless of what rich people think they have to have more. They don't. So let's say that we have a sales tax of 5% applied to these basic needs of these two people. Well, 5% of $2,000 is $100. So in other words, this sales tax on this person is 1%. And on that person is 0.005% of income. A proportional tax on sales is a regressive tax on income. A proportional tax on sales is a regressive tax on income. You are essentially, with a sales tax, punishing the poor for being poor. It's simple. It's not a liberal or a conservative thing. It is just the mathematics of it. Period. Now, the two other types of taxes are the regressive tax, where as people earn more, the tax rate on their last dollar goes down. And the system we have at the federal tax level, the regressive system, where as you earn more, your tax rate goes up. The argument for a progressive tax system goes to the idea of the diminishing marginal utility of money. You and Bill Gates are walking down the street together, and a $100 bill goes flying past. Are you both going to rush to grab that $100 bill?
No.
He's going to stand there and watch you get creamed in the street by cars. Getting that dollar. You see, because that last $100 for you is worth far, far, far more than it is to Bill Gates. That's a justification for a progressive tax. Economics, every course I took at the grad level in economics at a right-wing conservative school called Ohio State's economics program, my God, there's no such thing as a diminishing marginal utility of income. We don't need it. It's an unnecessary assumption. So they were all into this Milton Friedman idea of a regressive tax. Right-wing extremist economist Milton Friedman said we should actually stop even pretending. We should have a regressive tax. Have a higher tax rate on poor people than on rich people. What was his logic? Yeah? Well, they would, but there was even more to it. Friedman's theory, yeah. That's exactly it. Bingo. Friedman said if you tax the hell out of poor people, they won't want to be poor anymore and they'll make more money. Because they would. I kid you not. And that's still being promoted as the best way to tax there are actually economists who say that out loud, even to this day. Yeah, it's sort of like, we should put spikes close to the ground. That'll make people who are paralyzed want to get up and walk. God. But I kid you not, that that's legitimate, that is logical in the extreme right-wing economic schools. Now, understand that there is an argument against progressive tax as well. The way the argument that the rich in this country are doing everything they can to keep taxes on them from going up. They're saying, no, because our last dollars of income go to investments that create jobs. So if you tax us at a higher rate, what you will do is give us a disincentive. You'll take money away from us that we would be investing in jobs, in manufacturing, in service industries that would create employment opportunities. Their argument is that you're giving us a disincentive to even make that last money if you're going to tax it so much. The data does not support them. throughout the very rapid growth rate of the U.S. economy over the time since there have been taxes, it was only in recent years that the marginal tax rate on the last dollar, the highest marginal tax rate, until relatively recent times, was 90%. In many of the countries of Europe and around the world, the marginal tax rate is, the highest marginal tax rate is up there, 70, 90%. And that doesn't seem to destimulate growth at all. But in this country, it's almost, it's political suicide almost to say, raise taxes, steepen the marginal tax rate curve. Let me show you a quick calculation, because on the sheet you're going to have to do one. How we calculate tax a tax bill in our country. I'm going to switch over here to the overhead, PC, and take this off. In our progressive tax, and this is a corporate version, the first $50,000 of taxable income is taxed at 15%. But then if you make more than $50,000 but less than $75,000, that little wedge up above $50,000 is hit at 25%. But then if, let's say you made like $80,000, your first $15,000 would be hit at 15%. Then the next $25,000 would be hit at 25%. And then that little $5,000 above $75,000, that would be hit at 34%. Do you see how it works? So let me just do one real quick, back of the envelope, quick one. Let's say that it's $125,000, and I'll need someone to have a calculator to do this for me, okay? And this is how I do it. If I'm doing it by hand, I do it this way. I say, all right, we've got the first $50,000, and that will be taxed at 15%. And what does that come out to be? $7,500?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so now we're going to put $25,000 more, which will bring us to a total of $75,000. And that little piece is going to be hit at 25%. And that's $625, or is that $6,000? Ouch. And then we're going to have $25,000 more up to $100,000 there at that top one at 34%. What does that come out to be? What is it?
8,800.
Ow! And then we got $25,000 more in this company's, which brings us to what the company's earnings were. And that's at, 39%. What is that? So now you add all those up. 8, 8, 13, 0, 2 up there, 9, 15, 23. Does it come out to be 32,000?
Yeah.
Okay. There's your tax bill. Now, fortunately, there are tax tables and tax programs that'll do this rapidly for you. But notice something interesting. The marginal tax bracket for this company is 39%. In other words, the last dollar that this company earns at the bottom line is hit for 39 cents. But take $32,000 divided by $125,000 in earnings. What do you get when you do that? Matter of fact, give me four decimal places. So it's 25.60% average tax. The average tax will always be less than or equal to the marginal tax. So when you look at the average tax, you're really not seeing the force that the tax is having on the last dollar the company earns. Because if I just take the financial statements and take, well, I'm going to divide the tax line by the net income line, that's probably not going to tell you, or the earnings line, EBT line, that's probably not going to tell you the whole story there. Average tax is always going to be riding below the marginal rate. I want you to notice something. And I'm speaking here as a business person. Do you see that this actually isn't a pure progressive, our corporate tax rate structure is not a pure progressive tax? Do you see it there? Look what happens when you get to be one of those big fat-ass companies that has massive earnings at the bottom, right before at the EBT line. Their tax is less than mine. Or some small company. And why is it like that? Well, they'll say, well, it's because they have to do these adjustments for all these other taxes that these poor, massive companies have to pay. Bull crap. It's because those giant, massive companies have the political power to pull their marginal tax rate down so that they end up having the last dollar they earn taxed at a rate that is lower than a company that makes 125 grand at the bottom line. Just the way it is. And so you got to kind of keep that in mind, that there is this little punitive thing for being small. So obviously, I have to make my company bigger, and then I won't suffer this problem. And until I do, I'll just have to pay a higher tax than a very, very large company would have to pay. It's right there. And it's just kind of like, but effectively, if you actually look at financial statements, and we will look at them in the real world ones, you're going to see that at the bottom line, at the EBT line, the amount that these companies are paying can be shockingly small. In fact, in some cases, they're next to zero. How do they pull that off? Well, it's actually kind of easy for them. They create foreign operations and they funnel the earnings through the foreign entity. Now, all I want for you to do for this one, this part of the quiz, and it's available. Don't start writing like a violin fool or anything right here. You'll have a chance to do that in a minute. But see, you'll just put a plus or a minus to show events. That's all you do with this section, okay? And then you transfer those to ReggieNet as a plus or a minus in the box, in the relevant box. So that's all there is to that section. Now, I'll turn that back on here in a second once I've gotten rid of all this stuff. But remember how these fit together. It's like a puzzle. It's like a puzzle. Oh, I should bring up one thing. You see this cost of goods sold here? That's not on all financial statements. Cost of goods sold is stuff that is actually directly attributable. You can match up, I sold $400 worth of stuff, and I can exactly match, let's say, $100 to the cost of goods sold. There are a lot of expenses that are with a firm. Some of them, if you're producing stuff. Now, if it's a service firm, there's really nothing that you can exactly attribute. But with anything that has any manufacturing in it, let me give you an example. I will take a nice, beautiful photograph. I got a couple of real dandies yesterday, and just great. And I got one. Okay, I'm going to frame this. I'm going to print it, frame it, do a nice mat. Now the frame, let's say, cost me, in this case, that would probably be, that one's going to be about a $35 frame. The mat, I'm going to buy a mat board and I'm going to cut a mat, probably a double mat for this. And then I'm going to use printer ink from a massive professional printer that sounds like a jet engine when it's doing its thing, on very high quality Epson premium luster paper. And I'm also going to do a few other things. I'm going to sign with a gold pen, pretty on that. Understand that the total cost of producing that work of art, I'm going to sell it for $200. Let's say I do $200. Realistically, I can clearly attach the frame cost to it. No question. There is $35 of that $200 is that frame. Now, you could argue that the mat is too. Probably not, because I can end up cutting a couple of different mats and along with a few fingers and leave blood around before I get a mat that's exactly right. So even though it seems like I could attach the mat cost to the frame, not really. The printer ink, how in the hell would I know exactly how much of those 11 printer cartridges ink I use for this print? Can't do it. So you see, there are a lot of costs of making something. Some of those right on the button, but others of them, you can't do it. You decide that you're going to start selling dried flower arrangements in baskets with a nice ribbon and some potpourri in there. And some other ingredients I'll mention in a minute. Now, you sell these for $10. Obviously, the basket, that would be a cost of goods sold. You can directly nail that to that basket. The ribbon, well, are you going to use exactly the same amount of ribbon ever? Probably not. The potpourri, sometimes you just sprinkle a little bit, but sometimes you put it... Now let's talk about that last ingredient that goes into those baskets. We're talking about love. How did I just have a stroke behind? No, it's bright light. It's either Jesus coming to kick my ass or... shut the hell up. Okay, but do you understand? I can't attribute some things. Other things right on the button, but some things not. So the cost of goods sold would be directly attributable. But if you're a service industry, there's nothing really. So you wouldn't see a cost of goods sold line on it for something that was all pure service. Okay, now let me go and show you how to do what we're doing here. Now, these are two different companies. For God's sake, don't say, What does Company A have to do with Company B? They're different companies. I'm just going to show you A is for my example. B is the one you do on your own. So let's look here. Well, we're going to do Company A here, okay? Well, I need net income, but to get net income, I have to have expenses. So I'm SOL on that one. What else could I look at? Okay. If I had current assets plus non-current assets, I could get total assets. Again, nope, can't do that one. Let me look around a little bit. Non-current assets, current liabilities plus non-current. Oh, well, oh my God, spank me Muhammad. Cripe, I could lose my head for saying that. Looky there. I can fill in that guy right there. You see it? What would that one be? 100,000? 100,000. That's 100,000 there. Okay, so now we have the total liabilities. That helps us a little bit. Look at the retained earnings. Now, you remember there's a formula that I can use here. Retained earnings beginning plus net income minus dividends would get us retained earnings at the end. Well, look at that. We have three of the four pieces. Do you see it? Again, retained earnings at the beginning plus net income minus dividends paid is retained earnings at the end. The only piece we don't have here is the net income, so I can back into it. So in other words, I can take retained earnings at the end. I can add back the dividends to make $340,000. And then I can... Oh, so in other words, $300,000 plus what minus $70,000 equals $270,000. Can you tell me what it'll be? $40,000. So I got $40,000 would have to be the net income. In order, $300,000 plus $40,000 is $340,000 minus $70,000 is $270,000. So net income has to be $40,000. So 200 minus what makes 40,000? 160,000. Okay, so we filled in that piece. So now we've gotten down to the point where, okay, we've got now our capital stock and paid in capital is 520. We know our total liabilities are 140. So do we know what our total assets are? Or have I missed something? Okay, retained earnings at the end are 270. Capital stock plus additional paid in capital is 520. So we know that 270 plus 520 is what? 270 plus 520 is 790. That's your total stockholders' equity is 790. So now we know 790 plus your total liabilities, 140. 790 plus 140 is what? 930. So that would have to be my total assets, 930. Current assets, 80 plus non-current assets has to be 930. So we've got then current assets, 80 plus what will be 930. What is it? 850, is it? My mind is kind of drawing a blank because I'm not writing anything down. I'm trying to put too many things, memorize too many things in my head. In other words, the way you do these is to just work your way out. Find something that is vulnerable to calculation. So to start you out real quick on the next one, well, I don't have any way to get revenues or net income because I have just expenses. Well, that sucks too because I don't have something here. If I were to look around, oh, non-current assets plus current assets equals total assets. So since I know total assets and non-current assets, I can get current assets. Do you see that? Let me make sure. See, I've got a blank here on current assets, but I know that those plus 180,000 equals 410,000. So that one would have to be what, 230,000 right there? Is that right? That's how you do that one. So I even gave you one piece of this one. You got this one all finished up. Can someone tell me what I got? What were the numbers here, just so you have them? 160, 40, and then down here, 850, 930. 100? Wait. 100,000. It was 100? Okay. And then the last 790. Okay, so you got all the numbers there, and I even gave you one of them here, so you should be able to put it in fine. Okay, that one's that one, and then the other part is just put together a quick, dirty financial statement, get the numbers for that, and then I showed you this part. And that's your ReggieNet quiz 3. You should get an ace. You should ace it. That's all I have for you. Go home.